Thank you. Please be seated. Court is ready to hear argument with Tell Forrester versus Tanel.
May it please the court, Mr. Jewell will present argument to the petitioner having your 5 minutes for it. May it please the court, good morning, Your Honor. Officer Tell Forrester in this case is requesting the court to address three issues. The first is to what extent, if any, the Wadewitz versus Montgomery factors apply to this qualified immunity case, which involves an arrest as opposed to a police pursuit or emergency response. And the second is whether Officer Tell Forrester met his summary judgment burden of establishing his entitlement to qualified immunity in the trial court. And third, an issue the Court of Appeals did not reach is whether Mr. Tanel overcame his burden and overcame summary judgment by creating a fact question. We think that the trial court correctly granted summary judgment in Officer Tell Forrester's favor, and that the evidence shows that Mr. Tanel failed to meet his burden in showing that no reasonable person in Officer Tell Forrester's position could have believed his conduct was appropriate. I think first, our analysis has to begin with what the court did in Lancaster versus Chambers, when the court really for the first time approached the good faith, a detailed good faith study of, a study of the good faith prong.
Before we get
of
to
the
that,
qualified immunity.
If we were to adopt your position that Wadewitz doesn't apply to this type of situation, would we have to overrule any case law out there?
Not at all, Judge. I think what the court did in Chambers was to begin with the federal qualified immunity rule.
No. I know what we did in Chambers, but I need to. Do we have to overrule some 14th Court of Appeals opinions that have applied Wadewitz beyond this context?
In that respect, I would say that's probably true, particularly the Court of Appeals opinion in our case, I think, engages in a very rigid and flexible application of Wadewitz.
My question, though, is are we going to have to overrule other cases, and if so, which ones would we have to overrule? There are two cases out of the 14th Court that would appear to go the other way, and those are Geith versus Ziegler and Bridges versus Robinson. Would we have to overrule those cases to go your way?
The Geith case, I think, is distinguishable in terms of factually and in terms of the evidence that was presented in that case. And so I don't think technically the court would have to rule that.
Well, but before we get the factual piece, the summary judgment proof, just the argument that Wadewitz doesn't apply to that situation, would we have to overrule those cases?
Well, I would have to say that you would disapprove of them, I guess, so to speak, in terms of their application of Wadewitz. I don't think an outright overruling is necessary, that this court could be, in this case, really addressing the question for the first time. So I don't think that it's necessary to do that. The court can, in our case, apply the Wadewitz factors in, I guess, a more limited or more flexible sense than what the Court of Appeals has done, particularly the 14th Court of Appeals has done.
But in your argument that you just don't think that those factors that were developed in Wadewitz apply
to
an arrest situation.
Our first argument is yes, that is true. We think the court can begin with the federal rule and look at it and see if it needs to be modified, like the court did in Chambers. And I don't think there is any need to modify what could be seen as the federal rule in this case. And if when you apply that rule, I don't think there is any doubt here that under that test, there is no case that exists that would have put Officer Tell Forrester on notice that his conduct would have been clearly unlawful. In fact, just as a side note, that is kind of how this case developed in the trial court.
Well, let me ask you about you say the federal rule, which uses federal jargon, was lawful in the light of clearly established law. There's two cases from San Antonio that cast it or articulate it in a different way when they talk about basically how you submit it.
And that's true. And I guess really our real beef is really with the inflexibility that's shown by the Court of Appeals. And although we believe and we urge the court to accept really what that needs to go no further than the federal rule, I certainly acknowledge that since this court has decided Chambers and Wadewitz, the courts of appeals cases have sort of fallen along a spectrum in terms of how they have characterized the test and stated the standard for good faith, including the cases you discussed. Even if the court were to apply the rules that were adopted in those cases, we would still be entitled to summary judgment here, and the Court of Appeals opinion would still be in error in terms of concluding that our evidence does not meet our summary judgment burden and that we were not entitled to.
Maybe I didn't catch that, but it seemed to me your argument is that we ought to say Wadewitz and Chambers apply to either police pursuit or police response cases and not to arrest cases. Would there be a basis for saying that a suspect or a criminal defendant is not entitled to the protections of Wadewitz and Chambers as opposed to trying to distinguish them based on pursuit or response cases? Why does that not seem to be your point?
Well, I agree that, and I think as we argued in the brief somewhat, the policy concerns that sort of underlie it.
They have 1983. If it's an abusive situation, well, that's the defendant has that protection. But why should they get a negligence protection when they are the suspect being apprehended or being chased?
I agree. The concerns that sort of form the basis of the first articulation of Mead versus Risk in Chambers are not present here. Not only is this not a pursuit case, but as you mentioned, the suspect himself is the one who has brought about.
I could see a situation where the police, there is a high-speed chase, and the police intentionally ram his car, the suspect's car, to bring it to a sudden and abrupt halt. And the car spins out of control and hits a telephone pole, and the telephone pole falls over and some civilian is injured. It seems to me the civilian's injury might be subject to Chambers and Wadewitz.
I would agree with that.
But that would be a pursuit and response case, as opposed, and it would apply in those circumstances. But then, why shouldn't the defendant, the suspect, be excluded from that kind of reasoning simply because the police were trying to apprehend, and just leave the defendant protected by simply 1983 or the other intentional abusive cause of action that are available to them?
I would agree with that position, but of course the hypothetical that you present is just a little bit different in that the police officer has intentionally used his car as, I don't say it's a weapon, but intentionally used his car to...
Well, all the police pursuit cases are intentional conduct on the part of police officers, and they make an intent to pursue. And the question is, was that good faith or bad faith? These are all not negligence cases. I mean, we keep saying they're not negligence cases.
Our case really, I think, does fall into a negligence arena because the allegation here is that Officer Feldorster's weapon accidentally discharged during the arrest procedure, not that Officer Feldorster made a conscious decision to intentionally fire his weapon, and therefore would have made it a risk of need.
How is this pled in the trial court?
It is pled as I am presenting it. There is one claim in the plaintiff's petition, which is that for negligence.
So
discharge of the gun.
A claim under the Tort Claims Act?
I believe that's the pleading.
The use of tangible personal property that causes an injury to a person?
Yes, I believe that's correct. And the only claim is negligence, and there's no dispute here that there was no intent to discharge the weapon. I think the flexibility, if the court were inclined to apply a risk versus need type analysis or as a component of good faith in this type of case, is supplied by the court's opinion in Clark, in which it recognized that there does have to be some room for, flexibility. You judge the varying circumstances that are at play in different types of cases, and that just because a officer does not necessarily specifically mention each and every element or factor in the risk versus need analysis under Wadewitz does not necessarily mean that officer is not entitled to summary judgment because the needs and the risks may alter according to the case.
I want to ask you about your case, assuming you're right on the law. Wadewitz doesn't apply. It's a lesser standard. If everything the plaintiff said is true, and maybe just spin that out, their very best case scenario, they weren't resisting arrest. It's absolutely clear they weren't resisting arrest. The officer who was making a handcuff was completely in charge of and had complete control of the situation. Could your affidavit stand? Doesn't your affidavit assume certain facts?
Our affidavit absolutely could withstand summary judgment, assuming best case scenario for the plaintiff is that he did not resist arrest at all.
And that was absolutely clear to everybody.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
Why isn't there a problem?
There is not a problem. As the court can see from Officer Patton's expert affidavit, he has read the depositions, and particularly the deposition of Mr. Tunnell and Mr. Telthorster. He was aware of the contentions of everyone. He references in his affidavit the undisputed facts regarding the plaintiff's evasion from officers, which, as we all know, in this case, was he led Officer Telthorster on a 30-mile chase at speeds exceeding 100 miles per hour. That's undisputed. Officer Telthorster testified in his deposition that he saw Mr. Tunnell driving with one arm and moving his other arm through the cab of the truck, either in motions to attempt to throw things out of the cab or reaching his arm across the other side of the car so as he might be reaching for the glove box for a weapon. And the concern that Officer Patton has in his affidavit and the basis for his opinion is that a reasonably prudent officer could have believed that it was appropriate for at least one of the arresting officers to have a weapon drawn because of the possibility that Mr. Tunnell was armed.
And move in to assist.
Yes, I think that's true. Mr. Patton, of course, as you can see from the affidavit, is in charge of a police academy. He teaches officers and trains them. And clearly, when you look at his opinion, you can see that his conclusion that it was appropriate for Officer Telthorster's conduct is supported by the undisputed facts that are, he does not base his opinion on an assumption or an assertion that Mr. Tunnell was resisting arrest. And of the several cases, and I found a handful of them, in Texas jurisprudence in the intermediate courts that refuse to grant qualified immunity in cases where there is a resistance and a dispute about resistance. In those cases...
Didn't he plead guilty?
He pled guilty to evading the police.
But that was for the chase.
That was for the chase.
Not for the arrest circumstances. Is that correct?
From the record, that is correct. The record only indicates that he pled guilty for evading the police officers. But the cases that I have found that discuss fact questions involving a resistance of a suspect are cases where the officer testifies that his use of force or her use of force was brought about directly as a result of the suspect's conduct, whether it be resistance or aggravated behavior or whatever, and that's the key issue in the case. And here it's totally different because we have an expert opinion that meets the standard, who bases his opinion on undisputed evidence that had nothing to do with Mr. Tunnell's resistance. And assuming Mr. Tunnell did not resist at all, it was certainly reasonable for the officer to have believed.
You talk about that standard. The problem with the Wadowitz and Chambers standard is it's not really clear, and the court has never been able to articulate at what point you measure the police officer's discretion. And the problem with this is that Mr. Tunnell's going to argue, well, now, wait a minute. You know, I might have been doing all sorts of things at 100 miles an hour, but when I'm face down on the ground with my hands tied behind my back, at that point, the officer was required to exercise the discretion, and holding a cocked gun at my back was not reasonable. I mean, and the affidavit, it seems to me, doesn't address that discrete moment in time. And so now what happens?
I think it does, in the sense that Officer Pat has opined that it was appropriate, a reasonably prudent officer couldn't believe that it was necessary to have his weapon drawn until Mr. Tunnell had been secured and searched to make sure that he had no weapon on his person. Because Telthorster testified that he did not see Mr. Tunnell on the ground and could not have seen in his belt, for instance, whether he had a gun in his belt or in his pocket, and did not know at that time until he was cuffed and searched that he, in fact, was not armed. And I think that concern is covered by the affidavit.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Matthew Prebeg will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, and justices. The trial court in this case was not presented with a question of whether or not Mr. Tunnell needed to be arrested. Clearly he did. He made a mistake. He was a young, inexperienced, uneducated black man being pulled over to his mind for no apparent reason in a community he feared. He did something stupid. He ran home, beat the horn in his driveway, and wanted to be arrested in the presence of his family members. That's exactly what happened. The question for the trial court was not whether he needed to be arrested. It's the manner of the arrest. Was that necessary? What were the risks involved in the manner of the arrest? You can take the example to the extreme. A pregnant woman reaches in her purse and drops a gum wrapper. She's littered. Perhaps she needs to be arrested. And she starts to move away. Does an officer need to bowl her over, knock her down, and hard tie her and hurt her? That's the extreme. That's why the Wadowitz factors are very convenient.
Well, if we decline to apply the need and risk Wadowitz factors, if we were to hold that they didn't apply in the arrest situation, would you lose?
No, absolutely not.
And could you explain why?
Sure. The Wadowitz factors do not change the law at all. The Wadowitz factors merely provide trial courts with tools, a guideline for evaluating whether an officer acted in good faith during an arrest situation, chasing a vehicle or doing other things. A number of courts of appeals, 14th Court of Appeals three times, Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, as well as the Dallas Court of Appeals, have used the Wadowitz risk factors in judging whether an officer acted in good faith in a non-vehicular chase case. A lot of its factors don't change Texas law one bit. The standard is the standard for good faith. It's been enunciated by the federal courts and redefined, not really redefined.
Justice Hague had a question. It relates to the suspect as opposed to the innocent third parties. And would we apply Wadowitz in a chase case to the suspect?
Certainly. There is no public policy argument for differentiating between a suspect or anyone else.
Have we ever said that? Pardon? Has this court ever said that we would apply Wadowitz or Wadowitz to the suspect?
This court has not. A number of court of appeals have applied Wadowitz.
You say there's no public policy?
For not applying Wadowitz, the risk, the need and risk factors. In fact, there's no public policy reason for not requiring an officer to act in good faith during any kind of interaction
with the public. Well, but the public policy reason not to apply it to a suspect is that the suspect is creating the dangerous situation. I mean, there would seem to, the public policy, it seems that Wadowitz addressed, was danger to the innocent bystander to the public. I mean, wasn't that an undercurrent of public policy we were recognizing in there, that we're not really focusing on the suspect, but focusing on who could be injured in the process?
Indeed, Wadowitz involved an innocent bystander, as far as we know. The bystander, as far as any of us know, wasn't doing something wrong at the time. But to change the law, to say that Wadowitz doesn't apply to a suspect, is to say that an officer does not need to act in good faith when apprehending a suspect, because that's all that Wadowitz does, is help ensure that an officer acts in good faith when arresting a suspect.
Why doesn't the recourse under Section 1983 satisfy your concerns?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does. If you were to hold that an officer, there is no good faith standard for an officer in apprehending a suspect, then you would change Texas law, long-standing Texas law. There would be no state court of action at all for a suspect, such as a woman that litters and is bowled over and hogtied. The officer might not want to, clearly and truly, did not want to harm this woman. He did something extremely foolish, something that no reasonable officer who was similarly situated would have done. That's a state court of action. That's negligence, and it's acting in bad faith. That's a state court action. If you were to take that away, that officer, if this woman honestly admitted he didn't do that on purpose, it was an accident, it was an extremely bad choice on the officer's part, but he wasn't intentional, she might not have a 1983 cause of action. She might have no other form to redress her complaint. If you were to take that away, if you were to say that Wadowitz does not apply to a suspect, you would be overruling four courts of appeals. You would be saying, in essence, that the good faith standard does not apply.
Which one of those courts of appeals decisions applied it to a suspect?
Well, the Geek, Bridges, Ramirez, opinions all applied.
Those were suits brought by the suspect?
Folks being arrested, being searched and being arrested. Yes, sir. And Koppel, of course, did not mention Wadowitz, however, it applied Wadowitz without mentioning it. And that, again, was a suspect. So applying Wadowitz in no way changes Texas law. What it does do is provides a consistent guideline for Texas courts throughout the state in order to determine whether an officer acts in good faith during an arrest situation. And the 14th Court of Appeals recognized that the need and the risk for what Telfer did was not addressed by the summary judgment proof.
Let's assume that Wadowitz does apply here.
Does apply, Your Honor?
Does apply. The victim here is arguably not cooperating in the handcuffing. It's apparently needing two officers now to effectuate the handcuff. Why is there a need and a risk present?
That is a fact issue for the trial court and the jury to decide, Your Honor. But in this case, there were two officers involved, Bailey and a Telforster, both from the same jurisdiction. Officer Bailey unequivocally testified, as did Tennell, that he did nothing whatsoever to resist. He complied with the officer's orders exactly to the T, got out with his hands up. When the officer said, get down on the ground, he got down on the ground, was not combative or resistive at all. Those are the words of Officer Bailey. The officer, in truth, we believe, was the only one actually arresting this young man. Officer Bailey was handcuffing him and stated that he did nothing whatsoever to deserve being shot in the back or having a drawn weapon pulled out with a gun with a bullet in the chamber and a finger on the trigger with an officer hitting, making physical contact with him in that situation when the man wasn't resistant or combative whatsoever. That's the summary judgment evidence that the plaintiff has brought. And so, if the Wadowitz factors apply, the 14th Court of Appeals correctly stated that Telforster did not even put the plaintiff on his proof. But let's assume, worst case, that they did. The plaintiff in this case could not have brought ample summary judgment, arguably, to prove as a matter of law that Telforster did not act in good faith. Tinnell did not go out and get high-paid experts. He went to the source of the expertise. He went to the supervisors of Telforster and asked them what they thought about this. And they unequivocally testified, and this is part of the summary judgment record, that Lieutenant Wizzapoppy said, you cannot use a gun. You cannot draw a gun and be reasonable about it unless there's a suspicion of serious bodily injury about to happen. Lieutenant Litz, a principal in the Navasota Police Department, testified that they had policies and procedures that explained the only time you can act reasonably and pull a weapon. He testified that it is not reasonable under any circumstances to use any force whatsoever, any force, if the suspect is compliant. And the summary judgment evidence shows that the suspect was 100% compliant. He was never even cited for resisting arrest. He clearly evaded by not pulling over when he should have. He never resisted arrest, wasn't even cited for it. The superintendent of the Navasota Police Department testified after being qualified that just drawing a gun, not having your finger on the trigger, not having a bullet in the chamber, but merely drawing the gun is using not only force, but deadly force, and that it's not reasonable to do that under these circumstances.
Let me ask you about the affidavit under the Wadowitz factors, okay, and the need and the risk. And Mr. Patton in his affidavit says the officer could not have immediately known what motivated Tinnell to attempt to evade them. And there's a reasonable officer would be well advised, actually instructed, to consider the likelihood, the need to use forces to subdue the suspect under these circumstances. Talks about the danger to the other officers present on the scene. Why, even under the Wadowitz factors, couldn't we conclude that the defendant here satisfied summary judgment proof?
For two reasons, Your Honor. Officer Patton's affidavit is conclusory. He mentions as a predicate to his conclusions that Tinnell had resistive activity. He says just above that in the first paragraph, his resistive activity. The summary judgment evidence shows that there was no resistive activity at all. The bulk of the summary judgment evidence shows that. But even if you were to believe Officer Patton, even if Officer Patton had gone in and cited not only generalized things, but actual specific facts that proved that there was some resistive activity or some reason to suspect that there was a weapon. And keep in mind, all the officers, even the defendant testified, he never saw any weapon whatsoever. Even if that were present, Tinnell has provided summary judgment evidence to controvert that. There is a fact issue. If the court were to hold otherwise, that would mean that Texas law would be changed in all police arrest cases. If Tinnell had to prove as a matter of law that Telforster acted in bad faith, did not act in good faith. If he had to prove that during a summary judgment proceeding, then there would never be, and I think he has, but if that's not his burden, and if it was, these cases could never, ever go to a jury. They would always be a matter of law for the court to decide.
Isn't his burden, though, under settled law, that he must show some evidence that no reasonable officer could have done what was done in the circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. That was going to be my next point. Tinnell had a burden to...
How has he done that?
Tinnell had a burden to provide summary judgment evidence so that a trier of fact could reasonably infer that the officer did not act in good faith. That was his burden.
He must show we've been very definite about this in chambers, that no reasonable officer could have done what was done on the search. He has to have some evidence of that. Isn't that right or not?
Yes, Your Honor, and he has provided some evidence of that. And at the trial court...
And what is that evidence? That no reasonable officer could have done what was done. That's a pretty high standard.
It is a tough standard, and at the trial court, during the trial, Tinnell would have to prevail on that. In a summary judgment proceeding, Tinnell would have to provide evidence from which that could be reasonably inferred, and he has done that. He has provided the evidence from the other officer that was there that he did nothing whatsoever to resist anything. That he was going down, and...
That doesn't do it, it seems to me, because he'd been fleeing for 30 miles. Somebody does everything he can to, in this case, just say evade arrest, and then all of a sudden says, I give up. Well, you're standing there, you don't know whether he's given up or not. This may be a ruse. He may have a gun somewhere on his body. Who knows what is in his mind? Looking back, yes, he wanted to give up, but the officer wouldn't know that at the time.
The evidence was that Officer Bailey knew that, and Officer Bailey testified unequivocally that it was obvious that Tinnell had no weapon and was not resistive at all.
That's not the standard. Did anybody testify that no reasonable officer could have believed that this force was necessary?
Through the policies and procedures of the Navasota Police Department themselves, the officers testified that it is never reasonable. It cannot be reasonable for anybody.
But then they came back and they said he was eminently reasonable under these circumstances to have his weapon drawn when covering another officer during an arrest.
That's true, Your Honor.
Deal with that.
Once the plaintiff responded to the defendant's summary judgment evidence, within a couple days of the summary judgment hearing date, Navasota Police Department got those same officers that gave all this testimony that it could never be reasonable to draw a gun unless a suspect was combative. They went ahead and said, essentially controverted their own testimony within 2 days of the summary judgment hearing and submitted an affidavit to the court that said, but in this case it was reasonable. That really creates a fact issue. And I believe a jury would know what to do with
that. Well, it just sounds as though two different situations were posed. In one, the question was posed, a hypothetical. In a non-resistant arrest situation, would it be reasonable to draw a weapon? And no, hypothetically no. But they were not asked to opine on this situation particularly. When they were asked to opine on this situation particularly, they said it is reasonable if you're covering another officer during arrest to have a weapon drawn.
Well, they were asked about covering another officer during arrest, but you are correct, Your Honor. The question was never presented to either one of those officers. In this particular circumstance, did Officer Telfoster act in bad faith? That question was never asked to them. The circumstances, all the circumstances around this arrest of Mr. Tinnell were all presented to these officers. The officers were asked, under these circumstances, would this be reasonable? No, under these circumstances. What if the gentleman is running away but he's not trying to hurt anyone? No.
There's one thing that we have to consider here, at least that I'm thinking about, and that is, let's say we write an opinion that says there's a fact issue in this case. Then when police officers are going through training tomorrow or the day after this case is released, are they going to be instructed that in situations like this, after a high-speed chase over 30 miles, you don't know what that suspect is doing, that an officer has to keep everything holstered until throughout the whole process, so long as there's no resistance? If that's the case, what happens in those situations? And we've read about them in opinions and in the newspapers where, because an officer didn't act quickly enough, someone dies or is shot because of a concealed weapon. I'm just trying to look at this from a broader perspective.
The police officer, if this court were to hold that when an officer chases a suspect, the suspect gets out, the officer should consider the reasonableness of his actions.
He's got to question himself. He's got to stop right there and say, should I or should I not withdraw my weapon? Maybe not, because I might be held liable if something goes wrong. And so that factor is going to come into play in the officer's mind.
He would never have to worry about drawing his weapon, because the officer would be able to follow what officers do all throughout the state. They draw their weapon when it's reasonable to do so, and they do it in a safe manner. In other words, if they're going to arrest a suspect in a circumstance where two officers are present, and in this case there were at least five officers present, one is completing a handcuffing of the suspect, an officer would know it is unreasonable under any circumstances for me to put a round in my chamber, take my gun out, put a round in the chamber, put my finger on the trigger, and bump it into the guy's back. He would know that, absolutely, because of this case. But he wouldn't, officers throughout the state wouldn't know it just because of this case. They would know it because they all know that that's an absolutely unreasonable thing to do, because it exposes someone who had done nothing but drive right to his home to be arrested, to being shot in the back, and that's what happened here. And the gun as well went through the officer Bailey's hand. It should never happen. And this officer acted unreasonably, and he should be, he's different from other officers throughout the state. Your Honor, my time is limited. I ask you to affirm the 14th Court of Appeals opinion that requires the trial court to consider the need and risk factors of Wadowitz. If you decide to reverse the 14th Court of Appeals, then I would ask you to please remand this case back to the 14th Court of Appeals so that they can consider, if you're going to reverse it and say that Wadowitz factors don't apply, in all fairness to Tinnell, I ask you to remand it back to the 14th Court of Appeals so they can apply whatever analysis you decide is appropriate. And if you decide otherwise, then I ask you to remand it back to the trial court. If you believe that a different summary judgment burden was on Tinnell that had not been succinctly articulated and furnished to him, I ask that you then remand it back to the trial court so that burden can and will be met.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
The question was asked whether, if the Wadowitz factors apply, does the plaintiff win, or does the plaintiff lose? And I think that here, even if the Wadowitz factors applies, Tinnell has not met his burden to overcome summary judgment. His evidence does not rise to what this court described as an elevated standard in the Chambers case, because he does not have any evidence that no reasonable person in the officer's position with the facts at that time could have thought that the facts were such that the action was justified.
What standard did you argue to the trial court should apply?
In the trial court, when this case was being developed, our motion for summary judgment really relied primarily upon Chambers and argued what was really the federal standard. In response,
Could you articulate, what did you tell the trial court the standard should be?
Whether any reasonable officer could have, under the facts known at that time, could have thought the action was lawful in light of clearly established law, I think was the standard that we used. And in response to that, Mr. Tinnell didn't argue anything different. And in fact, no one ever cited the Wadowitz opinion in this case until the Court of Appeals did, when it issued its opinion. None of the briefing in the appellate court contained a citation to the Wadowitz opinion or analysis of the risk versus need factors. So the first time we see this is when the Court of Appeals issues its opinion. Again, Mr. Tinnell has not met his burden because he does not show that no reasonable person could have thought the facts were such as to warrant the conduct. The officer's deposition testimony that he attaches to his response simply provide opinion testimony on their part that creates a dispute between reasonable officers or officers of reasonable competence. which does not rise to the level necessary to defeat summary judgment. The other problems, I suppose, exist with Officer Tunnell's, with Mr. Tunnell's proof, is that I think that the officer's testimony in the depositions is rather subjective, and we know that this test is an objective test when you determine qualified immunity. And also, I would note that they were being asked about the city's policy manual and were simply testifying from what their interpretation was of the city of Napa's policy manual. They did not give the quality or quantity of evidence that is necessary to overcome summary judgment in this type of case. And really, those are the points I wanted to emphasize this morning. We believe that our summary judgment motion was correctly granted by the trial court. The Court of Appeals has erroneously reversed it. And, even if this court were to apply the Wadsworth factors, to some extent, that we are entitled to summary judgment, as even Justice Hudson decided in dissent in the Court of Appeals. And that the plaintiff has not, under any articulated test that could be adopted by this court, overcome the summary judgment. And we ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the summary judgment of the trial court.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.